cases, it comes in waves, but as we're now facing another presidential campaign cycle, we're keeping our eyes and ears open because we expect that anti-Muslim hatred will become part of the conversation in the public square, perhaps even in some of the political campaigns themselves.
In Sweden and Denmark recently, the Holy Quran was burned and defaced in appalling and unnecessary provocations. And with their governments refusing to intervene, sparking protests worldwide. Activists noted that if someone hates Muslims, they likely hate many others as well.
Not only do studies show that people that hold anti-Muslim views also hold anti-Semitic views, also views about immigrants and refugees, black and brown communities. And so we believe that in addressing anti-Muslim discrimination and violence, we're making an inroads to help people address other forms of discrimination and racism, especially within the United States, where our history of religious intolerance and racism intersect for Muslims.
The parliament is held every 2 or 3 years in different cities around the world, and it helps build relationships between people who typically wouldn't cross paths, and that has lasting positive effects.
When it comes to so many things are different from Islam, one of our core beliefs is that Allah made different type of people, and he specifically asked Muslims to go learn from the kind of people he made. They are all equal in Allah's eyes. We all are. So I would feel if I would be doing injustice if I did not talk to these people and learn about them.
Attendees said that seeing the range of the world's religious practices in one place, from Abyssinians to Zoroastrianism, produces awe, respect, and the recognition of mankind's indivisible unity amid a splendid diversity.
The parliament is a reminder that faith isn't a barrier, but the inspiration for cooperation, and that humanity's collective global problems will be solved by people of faith continuing to work together. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Tehran has hosted a conference to discuss the effects of sanctions on the health of patients. Speaking at the event, Secretary of the Strategic Council of Foreign Relations Abbas Araghchi rejected the U.S. claims that medicine and food items are exempted from sanctions.
There might be such a thing on the surface, but in practice, the actions taken by the U.S. administration have imposed a strong sanction in this area. The U.S. sanctions against Iran cover a very wide network, and in addition to the humanitarian exceptions that they have apparently placed in the field of medicine, there are very detailed conditions by the Office of Foreign Assets Control of the U.S. Treasury Department in a way that makes their implementation practically impossible for pharmaceutical companies.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has led to a disruption in the accessibility of vital medical supplies for Iranian patients.
The most important report in this matter was submitted to the UN Human Rights Council last year by Mrs. Duham, the special rapporteur on unilateral coercive measures of the United Nations. The U.S. and the West, self-proclaimed advocates of human rights, were against this reporter and even voted against the resolution to extend her mission. Even during her report presentation in September last year, they chose not to be present in the meeting hall. Self-criticism is not within their tolerance.
Although the U.S. claims that the sanctions do not directly ban the sales of medicines to Iran, they block every financial route needed to obtain drugs for patients suffering from diseases such as diabetes, kidney failure, hemophilia, multiple sclerosis, thalassemia, and leukemia.
Iranian officials have repeatedly condemned the sanctions against the Iranian nation as a crime against humanity, saying such unilateral restrictive measures have put the lives of vulnerable people at risk by hampering their access to medicine. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed to address the pressing cost of living crisis plaguing the nation. Attributing the situation to the global economic downturn, Erdogan has assured that his government will swiftly resolve this issue while upholding his promises to the people impacted by the devastating Fari earthquake. He had previously pledged to complete the reconstruction efforts within a year.
We vow to tackle the escalating cost of living caused by global crisis. We are aware that the cost of living has been suffocating our nation recently. As we have solved every problem of our country, I hope we will solve this problem again. We will not neglect anyone's right and will not leave anyone's expectations unanswered.
Analysts argue that this whole economic crisis is the result of wrong economic strategies and decisions made by the same ruling government for the past years, and they cannot fix what they have done now.
The people who created the problem and don't see it as a problem are very unlikely to fix it. For this reason, it's naive to expect from the creator of the problem to solve the problem. I don't know on what basis the president is making these promises. He spoke about the cost of living, which has been getting higher for the past 2 years. Every month, we have a new raises in prices from foodstuff to rents and fuel. When the new government came and Mehmet Şimşek was appointed, we waited for something positive to happen. But the lira value against US dollar is dropping, and we're not seeing any investments in the country. So where are all the new policies they want implement?
A few weeks ago, the vice president said that a new economic plan is to be revealed in September that will have a positive impact on the life of citizens, production and market, saying this plan will increase investments in the country.
Turkey, after the pandemic, was facing a few economic issues, just like other countries in the world, struggling to encounter post-lockdown repercussions, and then came the devastating earthquake, and then elections. So what we are facing, from inflation to change in lira value, is normal to what country has going through. However, I think the government's plan will ease the economic crisis, but it will take time, of course. When speaking about the economy, nothing can happen in one night.
This is why inflation is gaining a new momentum. The annual inflation went up from 38.2% to 47.8% in a single month in July. Lack of economic investments, inflation, low Turkish lira value against the US dollar, and high cost of living. This is how the Turkish economy is going now, with some blaming the pandemic and earthquake, while others say it is the government's wrong economic decisions. Amid the government promises and opposition criticism regarding Erdogan's extended tenure, there remains uncertainty regarding the potential success of the newly appointed economic team in swiftly executing their plans.
It's not that bad. Yes, the Turkish lira value has dropped and the cost of living has risen, but the government also raised the minimum wage and is trying to solve the economic problems which occurred due to the earthquake.
The ruling party must act fast to solve this economic crisis ahead of an upcoming critical local election, which will determine the fate of Istanbul, Ankara, and other major cities. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Around 800 delegates from 76 countries have arrived at the International Military Technical Forum held in Moscow region. Their presence showed a desire to strengthen and develop mutually beneficial cooperation with Russia, despite the West's anti-Russian sanctions. Addressing the participants, President Vladimir Putin noted that the U.S., along with NATO members, use all military and non-military means to pressure nations into submitting to their will, adding that all this is taking place amid a disintegrating arms control framework.
In particular, the United States intent on reformatting the existing system of interstate relations in the Asia-Pacific region as it deems fit. In fact, efforts to promote these so-called Indo-Pacific strategies are aimed at creating U.S.-led military and political associations. We cannot exclude that these efforts may pave the way to fully integrate NATO forces with the AUKUS structures as they take shape.
Putin stated Ukraine as a case which demonstrates where the Western policy of pouring oil on fire leads.
By pumping billions of dollars into the neo-Nazi regime and supplying it with equipment, arms and munitions, sending military advisors and mercenaries there, they are doing everything to further escalate the conflict and draw other countries into it.
According to the Russian Defense Minister, Ukraine's military resource is almost exhausted, and a special military operation has shown that there is nothing invulnerable to Russian weapons on the battlefield today.
No one should have any illusions that against the backdrop of a special military operation, Russian interests can be harmed. I wanted to draw attention to the fact that we also have cluster munitions in service. Until now, for humanitarian reasons, we have refrained from using them. However, this decision may be reconsidered.
This year, the forum is widely represented by weapons and military equipment that have already proven efficient in action. According to the Russian Defense Minister, the Russian army is expected to sign contracts worth over $4.7 billion at the forum. Iran has also presented a whole range of new combat drones.
Russia has expressed its determination to deepen technological partnerships and military technical cooperation with other countries and also continue taking advantage of the already established cooperation ties. The Army Expo's success is a clear indication that the West has lost most of its power in forcing countries to bend to its will. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
For the fourth time in 5 months, ex-President Donald Trump has been indicted and will be forced to stand trial, this time over alleged 2020 election interference in the state of Georgia. Ex-New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani joins Trump and nearly 20 others who will be collectively tried for violating a law normally associated with gangsters.
The indictment alleges that rather than abide by Georgia's legal process for election challenges, the defendants engaged in a criminal racketeering enterprise to overturn Georgia's presidential election result.
A conviction of racketeering in Georgia has a minimum prison sentence of 5 years. Polls have Trump as a certain lock to win the Republican presidential nomination, and he's neck and neck with incumbent President Joe Biden for next year's election. Trump has gained 8 points among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents since the first indictment was handed down, as the spate of court cases has many accusing the ruling party of persecuting political opponents.
I definitely think it's a witch hunt because, I mean, it's like crying wolf. How many times are they going to say he's indicted? And I just think, I do believe that it's also election interference. I believe that they really don't want him to run the establishment. I believe that they want to keep Biden in office.
A recent poll found that 12% of America says that the use of force is justified to keep Trump from winning the presidency, while 7% of Trump supporters say force is justified to restore Trump to the presidency.
I absolutely support it. And, I was just talking to my son yesterday when the fourth came through. And I'm like, you know, it's just hard for me to imagine that you could have someone, the leader of one of the world's best countries or used to be in the world, and he could try to overthrow a legitimate campaign vote. So, no, I'm all for the indictments.
The Georgia trial is the only of Trump's four indictments, which is likely to be televised. The indictments have often seemed timed to coincide to overshadow developments in the corruption allegations of Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden.
You know, we've been saying for a while that Trump is a criminal, and the issue is that we have a criminal system. So, Trump being indicted, we hope that he goes to jail. We hope that he goes to prison. I don't think that it's going to happen personally. But at the same time, you know, some of the people who are pushing these charges, you know, are also a part of this criminal system and also, you know, need to be held accountable for the things that they've done.
Trump's goal may be to delay the trials past the November 2024 vote, although he cannot pardon himself in the Georgia case, while Democrats are accused of slow-walking the investigations to tarnish Trump throughout the upcoming election campaign.
What the continued lawsuits make certain is that there will be no national reconciliation over the still disputed 2020 election, only further estrangement, and with no end in sight. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Two regional heavyweights taking significant steps towards enhancing long-term cooperation. In the words of Iranian foreign minister, relations that are now on the right track. On his way back from his two-day trip to Saudi Arabia, Hossein Amir Abdullahian gave Press TV the details.
The Saudi Crown Prince has ordered the Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan to take preliminary measures for devising the framework of a long-term cooperation document between the two countries. The document would be signed by the two sides during President Ibrahim Raisi's visit to the kingdom.
Amir Abdullahian's visit marks a milestone in Iran-Saudi Arabia ties, which were severed in 2016. This follows a reconciliation deal brokered by China.
We traveled to Saudi Arabia based on official invitation by the Saudi foreign minister following his trip to Tehran. Based on mutual agreements, we will resume direct flights and our joint commission will be re-established. Bilateral trade and economic ties will be restored, and both public and private sectors can start cooperation.
While all eyes are now on President Ibrahim Raisi's upcoming visit to the kingdom, Hossein Amir Abdullahian also announced that Iran has invited the Saudi Crown Prince to pay a visit to the Islamic Republic. An invitation well received by Mohammed bin Salman, who has said that he will be devising the necessary plans to travel to Tehran. Now it remains to be seen how this warmth of relations will affect the region and beyond. Isum Shahmadi, Riyadh.
In the limelight. In Britain, a new study has indicated that up to 3 million British people behind on their bills have had mental health problems. The new study has suggested that people with recent mental health issues are three times more likely to be behind on at least one key bill. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Up to 3 million people in the United Kingdom who are behind with at least one bill have experienced a mental health problem in the last 2 years, according to new research. YouGov polling for the Money and Mental Health Policy Institute charity found that 12% of all people were behind on at least one payment, such as energy, rent or credit cards, of whom half, or about 3 million, had a mental health problem. In all, people who have had mental health problems in the past 2 years are three times more likely to be behind on at least one significant bill, the report found, with 60% saying they felt unable to cope due to rising costs. Yet, only 9% have received money or debt advice since the start of the cost of living crisis. The charity Money and Mental Health Policy Institute calculates that the government could save more than £140 million a year and double recovery rates for people with depression and debt by joining up mental health and money support. It calls on the government and the National Health Service England to provide practical financial advice alongside National Health Service talking therapies. This would double recovery rates for people struggling with debt and depression, help an extra 27,000 people recover from mental health problems each year, and reduce waiting times for the mental health services. The authors of the new report calculate that these changes would save £39 million by reducing demand for health and social care services and generate £105 million in wider economic benefits and boost to workplace productivity, resulting in more people recovering from mental health problems. Martin Lewis, the chair and founder of the Money and Mental Health Policy Institute, said, "The cost of living crisis shows no sign of abating, and even if it does, The fallout will last for years. Financial problems and mental health issues are locked together. It's about time that treatments were linked too. For many years, therapists, mental health nurses, and social workers have told us they often spend substantial, valuable clinical time helping people with their finances. It makes more sense to leave debt help professionals to do that and take some pressure off the National Health Service, letting clinicians focus on helping people get better. Rachel, a 46-year-old from Cardiff in Wales, has had depression most of her life. But when she tried to come off her medication, she went into a downward spiral of spending and gambling and ran up debts of about £15,000. It's mad because the more debt you get in, the more the credit card companies will give you, she said. At one point, I had about 10 different credit cards. She says at no point did any health professional ask her how she was coping financially, and she felt unable to raise it herself. Suzanne Hoddy, a 37-year-old nurse from Leicester, says no one considered whether she could handle her finances on discharge from a mental health setting in 2017. Never at any point did anyone ask me, who's actually managing the house, all the bills? Is that going to be a potential issue when she gets home? She said. There was no thought of that. Had they done so earlier, Suzanne Hoddy might have avoided a court summons for failing to pay her council tax bill while an inpatient. Linking mental health and money services might mean an extra 5 minutes that you've had to spend with that person. But for that person's recovery, it's made a massive difference, she says. Dr. Subodh Dave, Dean of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, says psychiatrists were intensely aware of the significant impact of the cost of living crisis on patients' mental health. Dr. Subodh Dave said, debt may have disastrous consequences for individuals and their families. Clinicians can play their part by inquiring about their patients' financial situation and how this might be affecting their mental health status. Collaboration is needed from a range of other bodies, including financial advice services and social care organizations. A government spokesperson said, we're investing £2.3 billion of extra funding a year by March of 2024 to expand and transform mental health services in England to treat an additional 2 million patients. We've also helped nearly 2 million people out of absolute poverty since 2010 and provided a £94 billion support package worth about £3,300 per household to help those most in need. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. Employee assistance programs are usually pretty dull affairs. For a few decades now, employers have paid employee assistance program providers to run phone lines their employees can call if they need support with personal problems. The idea is to provide some short-term support, a handful of counselling sessions, say, to help staff deal with mild problems before they get worse. But this year, employee assistance programs have found themselves facing a swelling wave of complex mental health problems brought to them by people with nowhere else to turn. We were never designed to be a crisis line, says Bertrand Stern-Gillett, who runs Health Assured, the biggest employee assistance program provider in the United Kingdom, with more than 80,000 clients. But he says high-risk calls have now become a daily occurrence, ranging from child or adult safeguarding concerns to someone who might have taken a significant amount of pills, or they might be standing on a bridge. The company is hiring more staff and managers to try to deal with the rising complexity and emotional intensity of the work. Andrew Kinder, head of mental health services at Optima Health, another employee assistance program, ran an online seminar about bereavement for the employees of one client. He expected about 40 attendees, but 1,200 people logged on. People were actually sharing quite a lot of experiences about what they've gone through, he says. Antidepressant usage is also on the rise. In 2021-2022, 8.3 million patients received at least one prescription item for antidepressant drugs in England, according to the data, 22% more than in 2015-2016. But what's going on? On the positive side, people have become more comfortable discussing their mental health status and asking for help. That's an improvement on the past when we had this undercurrent of need that wasn't even being talked about, says Vicky Nash, head of policy at mental health charity Mind. But it's clear that's not the whole story. The loneliness, the worry, grief and financial problems caused by COVID-19 and associated lockdowns appear to have damaged the mental health of people all over the world.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Will this be a game changer? The United States has given the green light to the Netherlands to provide Ukraine with 42 F-16 fighters. This as NATO continues to supply Kiev with whatever it can in order for Kiev to defeat Russia, as hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons and military supplies have already been given to Ukraine to support the summer offensive that hasn't accomplished much. Will this new development end up being a game changer for Ukraine? And how will Moscow respond to all of this? Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program who's going to help us look at all of this. Glenn Deason, professor of political science, University of Southeastern Norway, out of Oslo. And Greg Simons, independent researcher and author out of Sweden. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start it off in Oslo. And Glenn, 42 F-16 fighters are a lot of planes. Are you surprised that Washington has agreed to this? And do you think that this will be a game changer?
Well, no, I don't think it will be a game changer. We've been hearing about this game changers all along, which is it's been from the all the weapons which have gradually come through. And but what is common though is the fact that the U.S. and its allies keep supplying heavier and heavier weapons. Things which were previously described as possibly causing World War III is now being supplied. So this, to a large extent, reflects the panic which is going on here in NATO at the moment, because Ukraine is obviously losing the war. Even the Western media has started to recognize this. But we don't want to negotiate on anything, including not even speaking about putting a stop to NATO expansion. So there's no room for negotiations, really. And instead, the goal seems simply to be to extend the war. And I think that's the purpose of this weapon. See, it gives Ukraine a bit more fighting power. But again, the desperation, I think, is important, because look what the U.S. has been supplying lately, and the British. It's depleted uranium, cluster ammunition. Now it's fighter jets. It's not going to change anything, but this is an effort to prolong the war. And hope that something will come up before we eventually lose this war.
Well, Greg, what does it mean when the commander of the U.S. Air Force in Europe, General James Hacker, says that Washington promises to deliver, but don't expect magic?
Well, I think it's pretty clear. I mean, this is just a process. I mean, as Glenn has said, I mean, this is not going to change anything. It'll provide more target practice. The point is, you'll have pilots which are not used to that kind of aircraft operating in a military environment where Russia has air superiority, or at least dominates there. You have the issue, where are these aircraft going to be based? I mean, Russia has been doing missile strikes in Ukraine up to the Romanian border. As soon as those things touch the ground, they're going to be vaporized by different missile munitions. So I think this is an attempt at, what should we say, expectation management. In other words, as Glenn says, you've had all these weapon systems, HIMARS, and all of the Patriot missiles, and all of these things. And it's all come to the same result, abject failure. And it will not change the result of this war beyond having more casualties on the Ukrainian side.
Well, Glenn Hacker, General Hacker, also said, quote, some types of weapons can be mastered quite quickly, but not the F-16. It will take 4 to 5 years to form several squadrons and bring the readiness of the pilots to a sufficiently high level, so there would be little use for the aircraft in the short term. I mean, what does this mean to you? What is it saying?
Well, it suggests that you can't just put an army together in this way. And this has been the problem, not just with the F-16s, but all the different weapon systems. Because Russia already defeated the Ukrainian army. What it's been doing since then has been to... NATO has been rebuilding the Ukrainian army by sending all these new weapons. So different tanks, armored vehicles, and all of these weapons are coming together. But this has already had a lot of problems. First of all, the people being trained for this hasn't received the proper training, because there's simply not enough time. We don't have 4 or 5 years. We might then not even have until New Year's, the way it's going now. And also, we have different problems in terms of the different weapons which have been sent. If you have 4 or 5 different types of tanks or artillery system, that's 4 or 5 types of different logistics chains. You need spare parts. Who's going to do the maintenance? Where are they going to be fixed once they start to break down? And overall, did you just spread them all out, put them all in one place? How do you overcome these problems? So you can't just throw in more and more weapons and throwing more and more men into this conflict. It simply, the quality of the army begins to deteriorate. So I'm not sure what they expect to achieve from all of this, these fighter jets. It has to be said, though, when the Dutch and the Danes are giving all these F-16s, it's not going to be delivered immediately. It's going to, the first, I think, is going to come around New Year, then a couple through 2024, and the rest thereafter. So there's I think it's more for optics and to show NATO's resolve as opposed to having to admit defeat, which we're not ready to do yet.
Right. So perhaps more like a PR play, it seems. I mean, Greg, does it mean that that mercenaries will be flying these planes in the interim when they said the way they're saying it? Or how do you see it? Why would they even be talking about this if it's really going to take 4 to 5 years unless they're going to be putting others?
Well, there is that possibility. And, I mean, that precedent has been set in the Korean War with the MiGs that were sent over North Korea. So you have that precedent. That would be the most logical option. But, of course, if you have a mercenary flying a jet, I mean, it's only as good as the ground support and, I mean, the advantage or whatever that they have in the area. And we've seen, I mean, Russian air defences are pretty good, not to mention the fact that their aircraft are much newer and better equipped than these F-16s, as Glenn says. A couple here, a couple there, spread over years. I mean, it's just, I mean, you have to be completely militarily ignorant to think that such a thing can make any impact on a war which is largely a land war.
Okay, so let me stop you right there. So you have to be ignorant militarily. So we're talking about these NATO people making these decisions, military people. So what does it mean, Greg? Is it that they're ignorant, or is it that they just don't care about the lives being lost? What's the deal?
I'm talking about the audience, because these people probably should understand that this will make no difference whatsoever. But for the public, the American public, the British public, the European public, oh, look, we're doing something, et cetera, as it says. As you mentioned, it's a public relations stunt and some virtue signaling.
Okay. Well, Glenn, does this mean when we look at who is gaining the most in this war so far or winning, it appears that it's actually the military-industrial complex. I mean, just sending and selling more and more equipment and weapons to the region. Your thoughts on that and how they are benefiting from this?
Well, that's probably a key calculation. Keep in mind, if these were our men, our soldiers, a whole generation being slaughtered on the front line with no chance of breaking through and no chance of victory, we would probably have sat down now and made, you know, some suggestions for compromise. But of course, that is not the case. We're fighting with Ukrainians. So there's very little cost, as American political leaders keep saying, there's very little cost, as well as American media, because it's the Ukrainians who are dying. So meanwhile, in the West, we're being able to weaken Russia, kill Russians, and effectively for the United States, there's an extra bonus because all these weapons being sent, these F-16s are being sent by the Europeans. So once they're shut down and destroyed, we will go back to the Americans and have to buy new ones. So the huge, biggest winner in this war, obviously, has been American weapons manufacturers, as the Europeans have emptied all their ammunition storage, sent their all their weaponry. Russia's effectively demilitarized NATO, and now the NATO countries are increasing their military budgets to buy new weapons, and this, of course, goes to the United States. So the U.S., of course, will make a lot of money. So from their perspective, this war has been good for many ways. It's caused a permanent divorce between the Russians and the Ukrainians. It's made the Europeans, which tried to become more independent over many years, has become much more dependent on the U.S., hence they're becoming much more obedient and committing themselves to, well, whatever Washington's saying. And, of course, the pure money of this. Of course, plane being shot down, every ammunition shell sent by the Europeans, we'll have to go back to the Americans and pay them.
Right.
And yeah.
Right. Well, Greg, in general, why aren't we seeing any negotiations, any peace talks taking place between the sides? I mean, this has been going on a year and a half now. With all these lives being lost, one would think that talks would be continuing and dealing with negotiations. Why aren't we seeing any of that? Instead, we have more fuel being poured onto the, you know, the flame.
There are a number of reasons, and some of these Glenn has already articulated. I mean, even before the war began, you had the likes of these odious characters like Victoria Nuland and others were salivating at the prospect of turning Ukraine into another Afghanistan, as they put it, for the Russian Federation. And so they, I mean, they're even talking about doing these kinds of things in a 2019 RAND report about creating these cost-imposing measures on the Russian Federation. You have the likes of these US politicians who are saying, as long as we keep on supplying Ukraine with weapons, they will fight to the last Ukrainian. So, I mean, this is absolutely not about the benefit of Ukraine at all. It's about US hegemony, especially in Europe, its complete domination. As said, Europe was getting a little bit too big, a little bit too independent for US taste. And it doesn't matter if you're an enemy or a friend. My only thing, constraint I see for the US at this moment, and this was mentioned in the Vilnius talks, was the fact that you got the US presidential election next November, and you had this timeline, if no results are shown, which they won't be, not positive ones anyway, for the offensive by November this year, then the US will start to withdraw or at least limit its support. So, I mean, depending on how unhappy the US electorate are with this endless war in Ukraine, and given what's happened in Hawaii and the disparity in aid to Hawaii as opposed to Ukraine, I would see it's going to potentially be a big election problem, in which case, like all other proxies of the US, they will be dropped.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Glenn, your analysis, I mean, what is Washington after? Do they just want the war to be extended as more and more weapons are being sent? Do they want total destruction of Ukraine and Ukrainians? I mean, you touched on it a bit, but I want to look at this a little bit more. What is the ultimate goal of Washington in all of this?
Well, in the beginning of the war, the Washington made his argument very clear. It was to weakened Russia. So, because over the past 2 years you had the U.S. being in relative decline, it's the era of unipolarity or global primacy has come to an end. So they stated very clearly the goal. It's to perpetually weaken Russia. So drain its resources, its men, and isolate it in the world, destroy its economy, and of course its military. So this has been the goal, and not just, as many American politicians have pointed out as well, it's not just to defeat Russia, it's also to send a clear signal to China that if they ever prepare to go toe-to-toe with the Americans, then the same can happen to them. So it is, as Greg pointed out, this is largely about U.S. hegemony. And So it's I think this is the main thing they would be after, simply prolong the hegemony, weaken adversaries, and make its allies more dependent. This war was very predictable, I guess, to some extent from in 2021, when they began to escalate this very clearly and rejected any compromise, even when they knew Biden said he knew the Russian invasion was coming. They still refuse to give in to any of Russia's demands in terms of what can be considered to be reasonable security concerns. No American missiles, for example, placed in Ukraine. Nothing. Everything was off the table. The Russians didn't want the Ukrainian ports modernized to have accommodate American warships. Again, all of this was rejected. So this is what we've been doing for the past 30 years. We've been constructing Europe without Russia, which means to effectively surround it with NATO bases. This is a policy of global primacy, which they have stated over and over again, part of their security doctrine.
Well, Greg, where are the Ukrainians, independent Ukrainians, in all of this? Do they not see that they are being used? As we've talked about already in this program, that the U.S. is basically saying that it hasn't cost them a lot, meaning there are no men on the ground there. So let's talk about the Ukrainian side of things. I mean, where are the independent analysts, individuals to say, hey, enough is enough. Enough of our boys have died. We're not getting anywhere.
They're either in jail or abroad. I mean, you're not allowed to say these things because of the draconian laws which democratic Ukraine has enforced. You cannot say these obvious and very sensible things, and it's increasingly difficult to say it in the so-called Free West as well. Independent and sensible thinking is not allowed. And that would be the reasonable thing to ask because, I mean, Ukraine is now a client state. It has no will of its own. It cannot act on its own accord. And, I mean, it's clear their role, and especially in the Vilnius summit, I mean, they treated Zelensky, I mean, rightfully so, when he demanded more, they showed him his place. So Ukraine is to do and die and not to question why.
Mm. Well, Glenn, Russia's former president and current deputy chairman of the Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, has said that the war could take decades. But regardless, the West is destined to face defeat, and Russia sees no alternative but to persist in this struggle. Your thoughts about that statement?
Well, it's because Russia considers this to be an existential threat. This will be similar to if Russia or China or Iran, for that sake, would try to establish a military base in Mexico on the American border. You can be very sure that the Americans would bomb every city to the ground before they would permit any Chinese military bases in Mexico on its borders. This is, quite logic. And the problem is this has become something controversial to say. But as we know, since the beginning of the 1990s, after the Cold War, so many American leaders, political leaders, military leaders, they all confirmed the same thing, that Russia considers this expansion of NATO to be an existential threat. You have CIA directors as well, like William Burns, making the same argument that Russia... If NATO would try to expand into Ukraine, then it would probably be a civil war, which happened, and then Russia would intervene. And as the CIA director said, this is not something that Russia would want to do, but it's because this is an existential threat, he would see that they would have to do it. So we already know, even here in the West, that this was going to be what was going to happen. And in an existential threat, in an existential war, we're fighting for your survival, they're not going to step back. Now, we can now say that we don't agree with Russia. We don't think this NATO and American weapons being lined across along the Russian borders, NATO trying to take more control over the Black Sea, that is not an existential threat. But there can't be any doubt this is how Russia sees it, and this is how it's behaving, and this is why it's reacting in the way it is. So from this perspective, there's no backing down for Russia. They will continue to fight this for years or decades if necessary. And again, I think this is worth taking serious, because in the West, we have this propaganda now saying that this was just an opportunistic expansionism. They just wanted to have some new territory. This is, you know, what we're saying. So our main argument is let's keep sending more and more weapons. We increase the costs, and then Russia will change its mind and back down. But this is not the case, and we know it's not the case. Russia sees this as a fight for its existence, and therefore anything we send, Russia will continue also escalate on its side. So there is no winning this, and I made this point many times. It's not clear what we want to achieve. We should be careful what we wish for, because if we want to defeat Russia, the world's largest nuclear power, and take Crimea, I think we're going to have nuclear war in Europe long before NATO troops march through Crimea. So it's important that we are honest about what this war is about, because as long as we pretend it was unprovoked, Russia just woke up one day wanting new territories, then there's simply no solution, and we'll continue to take these steps towards nuclear war.
And Greg, where do you see this going? It seems that it just continues to escalate. What's your analysis of it?
Well, I mean, what you see is the West having a rather dangerous gamble of the die, because, I mean, they anticipated that the sanctions would cripple Russia's economy. That was wrong. It's crippling European economies, sure. And, I mean, now you have the situation where Russia, according to GDP and PPP, is the largest economy in Europe. And that's the World Bank statistics. And so, I mean, Europe is getting deindustrialized. NATO, as Glenn said, is getting de-weaponized. People are hurting. Yet the politicians still wish to be, they have this slave mentality to Washington's geostrategic imperatives. So you're getting this big gap. I mean, it's going to cause a lot of economic and political problems, not only in the EU, but in the US eventually as well. Russia is, as Glenn said, it's not going to give it up because of the reasons stated. So the thing which will break it, if the Democrats calculate that this war as an election issue will cost them power in the November 2024 presidential elections. That would be, to use their terminology, the game changer, because the US political power is much more meaningful to Washington than this attempt to destroy Russia economically.